Today is Monday, August 6th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Kurigia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. To our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It is 5:04 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Today, we also have a report from a News 101 contributor, Alex Hamer, from Melbourne, Australia, talking about a recently published U.S. defense report discussing the Asia-Pacific region. Also today, we'll be talking to our News 101 correspondents, Claire Eagle and Iqbal Ahmed, who were at the Vancouver Gay Pride Parade, and they are on the phone right now to talk to us. Hi, Iqbal and Claire.
Hi, CJ. It's just me for now.
All right. That is Claire Eagle.
Claire, so you were at the Pride Parade this weekend, yes?
Yes, I was. So we were lucky enough, because we're media partners for Pride, for the Vancouver Pride Society, to have a spot in their box, their viewing box at the boathouse.
Ooh, that's fancy.
Yeah, so that was great. Definitely a great view of the parade, some fantastic weather, and right next to the MC, so we got the first info on all the floats coming out. So it was a lot of fun.
Nice. What was your favorite float?
Gosh, I don't know. I think there were a lot of different ones. I think in terms of the pure spectacle of the float, let me think. Celebrities Nightclub, of course, was pretty big.
Oh, that's always a good one.
Yeah, Trojan, like the condom company was also quite big. Surprisingly, WorkSafe BC, they were near the end of it, and they had a pretty fun-looking one as well. CTV and I'm trying to think who the other one was. Canada Trust.
Oh.
TD Canada Trust, they're the title sponsor of Pride.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a huge contingent of people out, and it looked like they're having a lot of fun.
Nice. And was it mostly, did you see families, young people? Like, what was the main group of people that were there?
It was a bit of everyone, actually. I was surprised. This is actually my first Pride here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
But I was surprised by how many young people there were. By young people, I guess I mean children. and
so there
were a lot of children walking in the parade, a lot of young families out there. It really seemed like it was something that all of Vancouver was out to see. And I think they said that something like 600,000 people come out into downtown for Pride in general today. So definitely was a little bit of everyone, not certain communities, not certain demographics, but a sort of a slice of just Vancouver life.
Awesome. Well, we just wanted to hear what that was like. We are jealous that you got to be in the VIP section. But thanks for talking to us, Claire.
Yeah, no problem. Great. Bye.
Bye. That was Claire Eagle reporting to us live over the phone. So we also have our weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, Dietetics Institution.
Intuition.
Oh, that was wrong.
And your weekday weather forecast with Phil Chang on News 101. Now it is time for provincial and national headlines. A 56-year-old man remains in critical condition in hospital after being doused with camping fuel and set on fire by another man following an afternoon of drinking in North Vancouver. North Vancouver RCMP has charged the 34-year-old man with attempted murder following the Saturday afternoon incident, which has left the victim with burns to more than 50% of his body. The man was found on fire in a field by the 700 block of Old Lillooet Road at 4 p.m. on Saturday. According to RCMP, both men knew each other and they had been drinking together in a tent hidden away in a field adjacent to Highway 1. The hidden encampment had a tent, sleeping bags, a propane stove, and lounge chairs all tucked away in the bushes adjacent to the highway. The victim was taken to North Vancouver's Lionsgate Hospital burn unit, and he remains there in serious condition after being placed in a drug-induced coma.
Some residents of the township of Langley, BC, are fighting to save a 25-acre forested parcel of land. The township is trying to sell the land, located along 84th Avenue, to raise the money to buy an old school in Aldergrove, which would be converted into a pool and other recreation facilities. But those who live nearby say the land is too valuable to sell, and they're collecting signatures for the cause. Langley resident Stuart Buschultz, who has lived down the road from the forest for 37 years, says the land needs to be preserved. He said, quote, "That's a rare, densely covered area of 100-year-old plus trees, and it's a different area, and we'd like to have it protected as a park," end quote. However, Bob Long, who is a councillor of the Langley Township Council, says that there are no plans to destroy the forest by selling it. Long said neighbors have gone too far in launching a petition to save the forest. He said, quote, "We felt that these properties were ideal for country estates. I don't think it should be assumed immediately that people are going to clear cut them or destroy the land. I think it's our idea to sell them to people that are going to enjoy them. It is a bit of a surprise that we've reached this opposition, especially considering we've conceded to other properties that we're not going to sell as a result of public outcry," end quote. That was Langley Councillor Bob Long. In July, the council reversed a decision to sell another parcel of forest at 84th Avenue and 252nd Street following a similar outcry. The land is now being preserved as an official park.
Union job sites across the province will see strike action on August 7th as the union representing provincial employees, the BC Government and Service Employees Union, BCGEU, takes 180 of its 65,000 members out onto the picket lines in Surrey, Campbell River, 100 Mile House, and Kelowna. Employees will picket at three Ministry of Forests, Lands, and Natural Resource Operations offices, a Ministry of Labour, Agriculture, Health, and Environment location, and one Ministry of Transportation and Infrastructure office. The union filed strike notice on these operations with the province's Labour Relations Board on August 2nd. With contract talks stalled, wage hikes remain a key issue for union members. Although forest ministry offices are on the list to be picketed, the union emphasized in a statement that their action will not interfere with forest fire response. Union President Daryl Walker told News 1130 that, quote, "If there are essential services agreed to between the union and the employer at any of these sites, the essential services will be maintained," end quote. Over 80% of BCGEU members saw their contract expire on March 31st this year. The August 7th actions will be the second job action launched by the union since the contract expired. The first strike action saw BCGEU members picketing three liquor distribution branch sites in Vancouver, Victoria, and Kamloops on July 3rd.
The BC Centre for Disease Control says breeding conditions for mosquitoes in the province are perfect and officials are on heightened alert for West Nile virus. The centre says the hot weather combined with standing pools of water from recent flooding will increase populations this month. Dr. Bonnie Henry, who is the medical director for the Emerging and Vector-Borne Diseases Program at the BC Centre for Disease Control in Vancouver, said that the Okanagan and Fraser Valley are most at-risk areas of the province. Quote, "Between now and the end of August, we know that the risk is going to increase. We know that we've had West Nile virus in BC in the last couple of years, and there have been a few people infected," end quote. Last year, there were no reports of anyone contracting the virus in BC, largely due to cool weather suppressing mosquito populations. One person in BC was affected in 2010 and two people in 2009. Only about 1 in 5 infected people get sick. 1 in 150 infected people will develop severe symptoms, including neck stiffness, disorientation, coma, and paralysis. Dr. Bonnie Henry is advising British Columbians to take precautions. She says, quote, the mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus tend to be more active in the evening, through the night, and into the morning. So if you are out at that period of time and there's mosquitoes around, the most effective protective measure is to use mosquito repellents. And the ones that contain DEET are the most effective. End quote.
A child and youth advocacy organization called First Call BC Child and Youth Advocacy Coalition is calling out the provincial government for creating a poverty strategy without money for new programs and policies. The provincial government's community-based poverty reduction strategy, announced this past spring, will begin this fall in 7 BC communities: Surrey, New Westminster, Kamloops, Cranbrook, Prince George, Stewart, and Port Hardy. If successful, they plan to spread to 20 communities by the end of 2012 and 47 by 2015. Organized around the idea that there is no one-size-fits-all strategy for reducing poverty, as distinct from the 11 province and territory-wide strategies that exist or are in development, government officials will begin to work with 10 to 15 impoverished families in these communities in September. However, according to First Call BC, that will not be enough to make a substantial dent in poverty in British Columbia, let alone eradicate it. In a report titled BC's Alleged Poverty Reduction Strategies, released by First Call BC on August 1st, the organization says the strategy is pointless without money and province-wide policies. In a statement from Adrienne Montani, provincial coordinator of First Call BC, she said, quote, if the BC government wants to be taken seriously on poverty reduction, it has to give top priority to raising welfare rates, raising wages in low-wage jobs, and removing barriers to earning income, such as the lack of affordable child care. Regional strategies and community involvement are important, but only if they complement action to boost the incomes of poor families, end quote. The report notes some of the federal programs already successful in lifting families out of poverty, like the Canadian Child Tax Benefit or Employment Insurance, are one-size-fits-all campaigns. In addition, assuming the 400 families the government hopes to help by the end of the year have 2 kids each, the report says the 800 children assisted by the localized program represent just 0.1% of the 87,000 children believed to be living in poverty in BC today.
The Canadian Federation of Students BC is calling on the province to follow the examples of PEI and Newfoundland by eliminating interest on student loans. On Friday, the Prince Edward Island government announced it was eliminating interest on provincial student loans in a bid to make post-secondary education more affordable. Premier Robert Giz made the announcement Friday at Holland College. The reduction applies to loans dating back to 2001. Those recipients will no longer be required to pay interest on the principal starting in October this year. For new applicants, the reduction will apply to anyone who has been an island resident for the past 12 months. Zach Crispin, chairperson for the Canadian Federation of Students, BC, says the average degree costs $27,000 in BC, and interest on a loan that size can cost up to $8,000 over 10 years. Crispin says the expense is hurting BC's ability to educate its workforce. As of March 2011, $1 billion in student loans provided by BC was outstanding. It would cost BC $34 million a year to eliminate the interest on student loans. The government says interest relief programs are available to help students repay loans. However, Crispin said that, quote, eliminating the interest would go a long way to make sure that British Columbians don't go into debt so that they can get an education, end quote. Federal student loans account for about 60% of a student's borrowing, so a change at the provincial level wouldn't mean students would be paying zero interest.
In an unusual show of environmental support, churches across Canada say they have a religious duty to speak out on the proposed Northern Gateway oil sands pipeline. Next week, delegates at the United Church of Canada General Council meeting in Ottawa are to debate a resolution that calls on the church to reject construction of the $6 billion Enbridge project that would take diluted bitumen from Alberta to the British Columbia coast. The resolution was drafted in support of First Nations communities in BC who worry a spill would poison the land and water, and directs the church to send the results of its vote to the federal, BC and Alberta governments and to the media. Marty Tyndall, moderator of the United Church, said, "Care of the earth is an important part of the faith, and the church can't shy away from the pipeline just because it is controversial and politically divisive. The United Church of Canada is not alone. Earlier this year, the Anglican bishops of British Columbia and Yukon issued a statement that questioned the integrity of the pipeline's environmental impact review. A group representing 28 Presbyterian churches in BC's Lower Mainland has written a letter to Prime Minister Stephen Harper that accuses the government of weakening environmental reviews and demonizing people who oppose projects as radicals trying to sabotage Canada's economy."
On the corporate side of things, Enbridge says it has no problem with churches weighing in with their opinions on Northern Gateway, but the Calgary-based corporation added it's concerned about whether people are basing their opinions on facts. Enbridge Vice President Janet Harder said the company has been working hard to explain the project to people who live along its 1,200-kilometer route, but hasn't done enough to explain it to the rest of Canada. Harder says Enbridge plans to release more information this fall about the environmental standards it would have for the pipeline and how the company would protect the ocean from spills. The information would include an advertising campaign in BC and Alberta and perhaps the rest of the country. Harder is confident people who are saying no to the pipeline now may change their position before the panel wraps up by the end of next year.
The current phase that the pipeline is in, the intervener phase, is to run from September 4th to September 28th. It is to examine the economic need for the project, how it would be financed, and the toll structure it would use. When the hearings shift to Prince George, BC in October, the panel to hear questions on the environmental effects of the pipeline and Enbridge's plans to deal with accidents and malfunctions. The final questions phase to be held in Prince Rupert, BC in November and December is to look at the potential impacts of the pipeline on Aboriginals and the environmental risks of shipping bitumen to supertankers in the waters along the rugged BC coast.
Striking students in Quebec are going to start voting this week to see whether or not they'll return to class. The end of the school year was pushed back under Quebec's controversial emergency law, Bill 78, which suspended the end of the spring semester back to August-September. With classes set to resume in the next 2 weeks, striking students will decide whether to keep the fight going or not, but tuition fees aren't their only considerations. Provincial elections in Quebec will be taking place on September 4th, and although student unions said they won't support any one political party, most are strongly opposed to the current Liberal government. Jean Charest's Liberals are under fire right now over a slew of ethics scandals, but they are getting public support in the handling of the student protests. This is weighing heavily on the minds of student federation leaders as they decide whether to stand back and watch the electoral process chew up a supposedly unpopular premier, or continue protesting and risk boosting his approval. One third of Quebec's university and Cégep students have been on strike for 6 months and are supposed to start going back to class between August 13th and 27th.
Change is on the horizon for farmers as the Canadian Wheat Board's monopoly on Western wheat and barley sales draw to an end. The federal government passed a law late last year to allow Western farmers to sell their grain to whomever they choose. That change kicked in Wednesday last week with the new crop year. Federal Agricultural Minister Gary Ritz was in Saskatoon last week to talk about what the government says is marketing freedom for the Western Canadian grain industry. The Wheat Board also held a news conference in Winnipeg to mark the official beginning of its new business model. Wheat and barley farmers in Western Canada have had to sell their grain through the board since the 1940s. The change has the support of many farm groups, which say producers can often get better prices on the open market. But supporters of the monopoly say the open market will leave farmers at the mercy of railways and big international grain companies. They argue the monopoly prevented producers from competing against each other for sales. The move has also led to several court battles. Board supporters are asking the Supreme Court for leave to appeal a lower court ruling on the way the Harper government stripped the agency of its marketing monopoly. They argue the federal government didn't follow a law that required it to let grain farmers vote on the future of the wheat board. A federal court judge, however, ruled in favor of those who wanted such a vote. But that ruling was overturned in the government's favor of the Federal Court of Appeal, which ruled that Ottawa did not break the law. The appeal court said there is nothing to prevent the government from changing its own law in Parliament.
Drought conditions in the U.S. are expected to boost Canadian food prices by as much as 4% next year. Extreme drought conditions in several U.S. Midwest states are causing corn and soybean crops to wither, and analysts say the effects will ripple through the food chain. RBC economist Paul Fernley expects food costs will rise 2.5 to 3.5% this year and 3 to 4% in 2013. Because corn is used to feed livestock in the U.S., Scotiabank's Patricia Moore says the rising cost of beef and pork will be the most noticeable on grocery store shelves. Last week, Tim Hortons raised the price of some baked goods and lunch items, and Maple Leaf Foods CEO Michael McCain warned it would too be increasing its prices. The U.S. Drought Monitor map released July 26 shows 64% of the U.S. in moderate drought or worse, and 46% in severe drought or worse. It was the fourth consecutive week in which the new record was set for the total area of the country in drought. In Canada, rainfall in most of southern and parts of eastern Ontario during the growing season has been 40 to 60% below normal, according to CBC meteorologist Joanna Wagstaff. Parts of the Maritimes and Western Quebec have been similarly dry. The Ottawa area has been particularly hard hit by the drought. A shortage of feed crops in the area is forcing livestock farmers to reduce their herds and put animals up for sale. Wagstaff explained that a stable high-pressure dome has been keeping the jet stream in northern Canada, contributing to the drought conditions in eastern Canada as well as central U.S.
And those are your provincial and national headlines here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay tuned for your weekday weather forecast as well as your weekly health segment.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia. You can also listen to us online at citr.ca. It is now time for your local weather forecast, brought
with
to you by
Phil Chang
from the UBC Storm Club.
Wow. Thanks so much, CJ and Nina.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, guys. Long time no see. Good evening, listeners. So, warm temperatures, lots of sunshine with little clouds. This is another beautiful week coming up here in Vancouver. The GFS surface temperature forecast loops, provided to us by the University of Washington, suggest for certain times in the next few days, the temperature could go as high as 28 degrees. Our own models here at UBC are a little more moderate. We're saying about 24, 25 at noon for the next few days, which is a little more in line with what Environment Canada is predicting, too. But whatever the case, two things are for sure. It's going to be hot, and the sun is going to be up high, dishing out lots and lots of radiation each day. So here again, I'd like to remind everyone, not to expose yourself to excess solar radiation. Avoid the midday sun, and generally speaking, consider slapping on some sunscreen before heading out the door on days of UV index 6 or higher. Awesome. Now here's your Vancouver's weather summary for this coming week. Tonight, cloudy with 40% chance of shower this evening. Risk of thunderstorms near the mountains. But the better chance is that it will be clear with a low of 17. Tuesday, sunny, high of 26. UV index 7 or higher. Tuesday night, a few clouds. Increased cloudiness after midnight. Low of 17. Wednesday, sunny, high of 23. Thursday, sunny, low of 14, high of 23. Friday, also sunny, low of 15, high of 23. So that's your weekday weather summary, courtesy of Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang. I'm from the UBC Storm Club. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Phil. That sounds great. I'm looking forward to that sunshine.
Yeah. Well, that was the weather and your provincial and national headlines. And now we are going to go to our weekly health segment.
And this time it is on breastfeeding and mothers.
Welcome to your weekly health beat on CITR 101.9 FM.
It's Dietetic Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice.
What are you going to hear? We'll bust nutrition myths, give tips, do book reviews, as well as interviews, you name it. And now here are your dietetic students, Andrea, Jessica, and Sharon, for this week's segment.
Hi, everyone. Today we're talking about World Breastfeeding Week, and it's kind of interesting that we're talking about it at this time when there's been a lot of coverage in the media regarding mothers breastfeeding in public and also to what age of their kids. So we want to emphasize from a health perspective, breastfeeding really is the gold standard, and there are some recommendations from Health Canada and Dietitians of Canada where they recommend that infants are exclusively breastfed for the first 6 months of their life and for up to 2 years with solid food. And we want to point out, though, that this can be a little unrealistic sometimes. There's more, you know, mothers working now, and also the process of breastfeeding can be a little tricky. Having the child latch on properly is usually a very frustrating issue for some moms. So there is another option where you can try formula, and it has its own benefits. It's convenient, it's always available, so you're traveling or something, you don't have to worry about that. And it is an alternative to mothers who have chronic diseases such as HIV, for example. An interesting thing is that there's a breastfeeding bank for women in Vancouver and BC. It's associated with BC Women's Children's Hospital, and we'll have the information on our blog after the segment. But, you know, basically we just want to emphasize it's really mom's choice, and either option is okay. Now, if you want to explore more of that controversy regarding the whole breastfeeding thing, there is a website that you can go to. It's called infactcanada.ca, and we'll have the link on our blog again after the segment. So, like we mentioned before, because breastfeeding really is the gold standard, we'll talk about the benefits for the mom and the baby. It is an emotional bonding period for the mom and the baby. So, you know, that's a really great option. But also, it decreases the risk of breast cancer and possibly the decreased risk of ovarian cancer and diabetes for the mother. And a really great thing is that it may help the mom return to her pre-pregnancy weight by increasing her metabolism. And then for the baby, it's known as the perfect baby food. It's easier to digest than formula, and it causes less diarrhea and constipation for the baby, so that's nice. Also, it lowers the risk of chronic disease later in life and the chance of developing allergies decreases, and then the defense against infections increases. So it also promotes proper jaw and tooth development. So if you want your baby to have great teeth later on in life, breastfeeding is a good option. So Andrea's going to talk more about the nutrition around this.
Okay, thanks, Sharon. So a question that comes up a lot is whether breast milk is enough to support your baby's growth all by itself. Do I need to use supplements? And the answer is yes and no. So yes, breast milk provides enough energy, protein, and fat to support your baby's health, but it's really important to note that breast milk does not contain sufficient vitamin D to make sure that your baby builds the strong bones that it needs. So Health Canada recommends about 400 international units of vitamin D per day for breastfed babies, so that's important to keep note of. Is there a specific diet I should be following while I'm breastfeeding? That's a question that we get a lot as well. Canada's food guide recommends approximately an extra 500 calories or 2 to 3 extra servings of food per day. Now, what this would look like is maybe a fruit and yogurt for snack, maybe an extra glass of milk at dinner, or an extra piece of toast at breakfast. But the important thing to know is as long as you're getting variety and eating from all different food groups, that should be enough with the extra snacks. Now, what food should I avoid while breastfeeding? So fish is generally something that is considered really good, and it is really good. It's a great source of omega-3 fatty acids, which is important for promoting brain health. But it's also important to note that fish can contain mercury, particularly the bigger fish. And this can damage a developing brain, particularly those of babies. So if possible, stick to fish that are lower in mercury, such as salmon, sole, and shrimp, and baby will do just fine. Another thing I wanted to talk about is caffeine. Babies can be very sensitive to caffeine. Caffeine can enter the breast milk and it can disrupt sleep patterns and eating habits. So if possible, limit caffeine to 300 milligrams or less per day. And this, if you don't know what it looks like, is approximately 1 to 2 6-ounce cups of tea or coffee or any other caffeinated drink. Last thing I want to talk to you about, a food to avoid, is alcohol. I'm sure you know alcohol enters the breast milk as well, and this may also, like caffeine, disrupt the baby's sleeping patterns, but it can also decrease the amount of milk you produce at feedings. So if you're looking to have an easier feeding time, consider maybe having a little less alcohol or abstaining from alcohol completely during breastfeeding.
Also, we'll have a couple links to good breastfeeding websites, and it'll be posted on our blog, so check that out. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in again this week.
If you missed us, please go to blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition or follow us on Twitter at CITR Health, and even like us on Facebook at Dietetics Intuition. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Thank you to our Dietetics Intuition team for that health segment. You can, of course, listen to that once again on our Mixcloud page as well. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM. It is now time for our international headlines. But first, we go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman interviews Bill McKibben, co-founder and director of 350.org, and a world-renowned environmentalist and writer.
Democracy Now! Talk about global warming, where it stands today, what needs to be done.
Well, look, we're really seeing this summer around the world, despite what Dr. Mueller was peddling a minute ago, what climate change looks like in its early stages. It's been a pretty scary summer, not just here in this country where we're seeing epic heat and drought, but up on Greenland, maybe the most important place in the world, where the science and the actualities of what's going on are sort of clearer day by day by day. We're seeing record melt. We're seeing snow turning to water and soaking up more of the sun's heat. It's been a ragged summer. And the point of this piece in Rolling Stone, which oddly enough, though it's fairly mathematical, has gone kind of viral. The point of it is we now know enough to know what the future holds unless we change fast. The piece points out that scientists have long told us that if we want to stay below 2 degrees warming, which is what every government in the world, even the most conservative, have adopted as the bottom line, we can only burn 565 more gigatons of carbon. Unfortunately, a new analysis by a bunch of UK financial analysts showed that the fossil fuel industry and those countries that kind of operate like the fossil fuel industry, you know, Venezuela or Kuwait, have in their reserves 2,795 gigatons of carbon in their coal and gas and oil. That's still below ground, but economically, it's essentially above ground. They're borrowing money against it. Their share prices are based on it. Unless we change things very dramatically, it's going to get burned, and we are going to overwhelm the climate system.
Bill McKibben,
so
you're...
we're going to need to stand up to that industry. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Your assessment of Dr. Mueller's conversion, as he describes it, now saying that global warming is human-caused.
It's scientifically not very interesting because, most scientists figured it out 20 years ago, and all he's done is confirm their work. Politically, it's interesting because we're reaching the point where even the kind of industry-funded deniers can't, with a straight face, say that it's not warming. In fact, Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson 2 weeks ago, probably more importantly, said, yes, forget all the things that my predecessors have said about how global warming was a hoax. Global warming is real, and we're causing it. He then went on to say, but it's an engineering problem with engineering solutions, and the example that he gave was, if we need to move our crop production areas, we will. By crop production areas, I think he means what the rest of us call farms. And if you look at an atlas, there's really not a lot of room to move them. You can't take an Iowa cornfield where we're not going to grow any corn this year because of the heat and drought and somehow transplant it up to the melting Arctic tundra, because when you get up there, there's no soil. What needs to be adapted is not our crop production areas. What needs to be adapted are the business plans of the fossil fuel industry. They need to stop exploring for more hydrocarbons. They need to stop warping our democracy by buying off the House and the Senate. And instead, we need to put the most obvious thing to do, what every economist now for 20 years have been saying,
5 seconds,
a stiff price on carbon to reflect the damage that it does. And that's one of the things we work on at 350.org.
We want to thank you very much, Bill McKibben, for being with us. We'll link to your piece at Rolling Stone. That does it for our broadcast. A happy belated birthday to Sumner Ryland. Special thanks to our Baltimore crew.
Thanks to Democracy Now! For that segment. And now we are going to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, for more international news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Before dawn early this morning, Syria's Prime Minister Riyad Hijab and his family crossed into Jordan. Syrian state media reported that Hijab was fired from his post, but hours later his spokesperson, Mohammed Al-Itri, read the following statement.
Today, I declare to the masses of the Syrian people that I have defected from the terrorist murderous regime and joining the Holy Revolution.
Hijab is the highest-level civilian official in the Syrian government to defect to date. Also today, a Syrian state TV facility in Damascus was bombed. 3 people were hurt. And according to the Daily Telegraph, the U.S. Treasury Department gave approval to the Washington-based Syrian support group to provide money and other support to the rebels that would otherwise be blocked by sanctions. Vietnamese authorities detained more than 24 people on Sunday who were protesting China's actions in a dispute over the South China Sea, a body of water that's home to vital shipping lanes and believed to be rich in oil. FSRN's Mike Ives has more.
Vietnamese security forces on Sunday detained more than 24 people who were protesting China's recent actions in the South China Sea. Human Rights Watch said the protesters were rounded up in central Hanoi and driven to detention facilities around the city. One was Le Hien Duc, an 81-year-old former elementary school teacher known for her public crusades against corruption. Duc was released early Sunday afternoon. Vietnam's communist government doesn't tolerate dissent, but occasionally allows anti-China demonstrations to occur on Sundays in its capital. Tensions are rising between China and its Southeast Asian neighbors over competing claims to territories in the South China Sea. Boats from China and the Philippines squared off there in April. In June, Vietnam claimed jurisdiction over 2 contested island chains in the sea. And in late July, China announced it was creating a new city on a South China Sea island and equipping it with a military garrison. Sunday's demonstration occurred at the same time as more than 100 people staged Vietnam's first ever gay pride parade in a separate part of town. Reporters covering the event did not witness any police interference. Mike Ives, FSRN, Hanoi.
A U.S. judge refused to grant bail for a Catholic Church official convicted of covering up child abuse by priests. Monsignor William Lin was found guilty of child endangerment in June. He will remain jailed during his appeal. Health officials in central India are using GPS tracking to monitor sonograms in an attempt to control gender selection. Privacy advocates are concerned. Shreya Niazi reports.
Faced with a declining birth rate ratio of girls to boys, the Health Department of Madhya Pradesh in central India has started installing active tracking devices in sonography centers on a pilot basis. The GPS-enabled devices began transmitting data as soon as the ultrasound machines are turned on and can send video. According to the 2011 census, the sex ratio in Madhya Pradesh stands at 892 girls per 1,000 boys. State officials believe that the GPS sonogram tracking will curb illegal pregnancy terminations done for the purpose of gender selection. The Indian Radiological and Imaging Association, or IRIA, is opposed to the monitoring. They say that only about 5% of all sonography tests are pregnancy-related, and that intercepting the results of such diagnostics violates the human rights and privacy of patients. Shuranyazi, FSRN, Bhopal.
Following a deadly attack near the Egypt-Gaza border on Sunday, Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi vowed to enforce security in the Sinai Peninsula. Rami El-Maghari reports from Cairo.
Egyptian authorities called for a 3 days of mourning following a deadly attack yesterday that killed 16 Egyptian soldiers and injured 7 others near Gaza-Egypt border. The attack occurred as the soldiers were about to break their daily Ramadan fast. Dozens of attackers breached the Gaza-Egypt border. Egyptian authorities have indefinitely closed the Rafah crossing terminal and beefed up security in the border area. In Gaza, Hamas condemned the attacks and ordered that hundreds of underground tunnels along the border with Egypt shut down. Dr. Mohammed Saeed is a chief for security studies at the Cairo-based Al-Ahram Center for Political and Strategic Studies. Dr. Saeed downplays accusations that attackers were Gaza-based.
Such a form of terrorism is already present and rather deeply rooted in Sinai.
Some of the attackers were reportedly killed. The Israeli army says it killed 7 Palestinians who tried to cross the Israeli border in 2 armored vehicles belonging to the dead Egyptian soldiers. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Cairo.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
As violence continues in Syria, human rights advocates are warning of a food and agriculture crisis. Millions could be affected this year, according to the United Nations and the Syrian Ministry of Agriculture and Agrarian Reform. Wheat, barley, fruit and vegetable crops, livestock and poultry are all affected, with many farms being neglected because of the rise in fuel costs and shortage of migrant labour. The study also found rural and female-headed households are severely affected. UN Radio's Mamadou Alpha Diallo spoke to the World Food Programme's Abir Tefa about the report's findings.
The World Food Programme and FAO did a joint rapid food security needs assessment with the Syrian government. This assessment has shown us that 3 million people are in need of food, crop and livestock assistance over the coming year. Out of this number, we have 1.5 million people that need urgent and immediate food assistance over the next 3 to 6 months, especially in the areas that have been hit hard by the conflict and where we see a large population displacement.
And WFP representative and country director in Syria says that during the mission visit to Al-Hasake, even the richest family in a village reported having food stock for only 1 more month. Should we fear the worst for vulnerable people?
situation is actually very bad for many of these families. The humanitarian situation on the ground is deteriorating. One-third of the rural population is facing very difficult times in feeding their families and putting food on the table. Economic implications of these losses are quite grave. I mean, it's not easy when a country is facing all of these civil unrest and at the same time recovering from many years of drought. The northeast of Syria and Hasaka has particularly faced 5 consecutive years of drought.
And the assessment reports that as many as 3 million people are in need of assistance over the next 12 months. Which area are most affected by the crisis?
Mainly the rural areas. So the rural areas of Syria are affected by the crisis all over the country, whether it is in the northeast, the southeast, it is all over the country.
And what are your worst scenario right now in Syria?
The worst case scenario is that if we are not granted safe access, if we don't have enough funding to address the needs of these people immediately, the situation will get worse. We could see the Syrian agriculture completely dying, as well as, of course, the nutritional status of many families will just go completely the wrong way.
The Joint Mission final report says that the Syrian agriculture sector has lost a total of $1.8 billion this year as a result of the ongoing crisis. What are the effects of these major losses on a daily basis?
Yes, as you mentioned, the report has said that $1.8 billion have been lost in the agricultural sector this year because of the ongoing crisis, which includes losses and damage to crops and livestock. And the strategic crops which the country depend on, such as wheat and barley, have been affected, as well as all of the fruit like cherry and olive trees and vegetable production. This means that we have 3 million people who have lost their livelihoods. Farmers, small herders, which is one-third of the rural population, in addition to 10% of this number is female-headed households. So we really have a difficult situation of families that have already been suffering, going really on a more difficult situation.
That was the World Food Programme's Abir Atefa discussing a new report by the United Nations and Syrian Ministry of Agriculture and Agrarian Reform about the current food and agriculture crisis facing the country. For a link to the report, go to our website, fsrn.org. Tibetans living in exile say another self-immolation took place today in Sichuan Province, China. This follows the death last week of another protester who set himself on fire in June. Dozens of Tibetans have self-immolated this year to protest against China's occupation of their homeland. More than 20 of them have died. It's often difficult to find out details about the protests, as journalists are prohibited from travelling to Tibet. But news of the self-immolation does reach exiled communities outside of Tibet, including in India's Dharamshala. The mountainous area is home to the largest Tibetan community outside of Tibet and to the government in exile. FSRN's Felix Gaitke and Gayatri Parameswaran spoke to Tibetans there about the protests and their struggle.
Hundreds of Tibetans have gathered at Dharamshala's football stadium. They're holding a candlelight vigil to commemorate those who self-immolated. People from all walks of life are here. Young children and workers, students and housewives, political leaders and Buddhist monks. They are in mourning.
And the latest report that we have says that Dorje Tseten, 19-year-old, he passed away.
Sevang Rigzin, president of the Tibetan Youth Congress, addresses the crowd.
The Tibetan struggle over the last 53 years under Chinese occupation has been nonviolent. And all credit goes to the leadership of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Having said that, we are seeing all the self-immolations lately. And with this, self-immolations, being a nonviolent struggle, we the Tibetan people does not have many options left. Self-immolations and hunger strike are the two last resorts that we have, and we don't have anything else.
On every street corner of the city, the Tibetan Youth Congress has put up posters of what they call the Burning Martyrs. They show profile photos of the protesters set against a background of fire. The posters also surround the entrance to the offices of the government in exile. Tashi, who goes by one name, is a government spokesperson.
Tibetans inside Tibet have no basic human rights at all. Particularly, the monks and nuns are being denied to practice their religion freely. For 24 hours, monasteries and nunneries are being controlled by the Chinese authority. And the Tibetans are forced to denounce His Holiness Dalai Lama.
Tashi adds that there's nothing they can do to stop the immolations.
You know, this, I think, it's all in the hands of the Chinese authorities. If they stop this wrong policy, if they really consider the grievances of the Tibetans, what are their demands, then I think there's hope that people may stop it. So it's all in the hands of the Chinese authorities, you know.
Tibet has its own national flag, currency, and a distinct culture and religion. China invaded and occupied it in 1949 for both strategic and economic reasons. In China, now those who discuss a free Tibet can still be jailed and charged with endangering state secrets. Human Rights Watch says that China maintains highly repressive policies in ethnic Tibetan areas. Most of the self-immolating protesters held official monastery positions or had been enrolled there as students. Kirti Monastery is in China's Sichuan province, an area with strong Tibetan culture. The monastery has been at the epicenter of the protests. Kanyak Sering, a monk and spokesperson of the monastery, now lives in exile in Dharamshala. He explains the self-immolations from a spiritual viewpoint.
I don't know what the self-immolators thought before they set themselves on fire, and I don't know whether they thought about the consequences of self-immolation for themselves. But what I can tell you is that they all left behind a letter or a message before they set themselves on fire. The letters are very obvious. They always hope for a free Tibet and for His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, to return to Tibet. So those are their slogans. So to my mind, they are self-immolating for other people, the 6 million Tibetan people. So it's not negative even when you look at it from a Buddhist point of view, because they are not doing it for selfish reasons, but for a greater good.
The protesters want to make sure the world knows about the situation in Tibet. The protests have now spread to neighboring countries, including Nepal and India. In March, 27-year-old Tibetan exile Jamphel Yeshi set himself on fire in India's capital, New Delhi. 2 days later, he died in hospital.
Firstly, I want to express to the sky.
Yeshi's friend Lobsang Jinpa witnessed the protest.
There was going to be a demonstration for Tibetan freedom in Delhi that day. Jamphel Yeshi didn't go with me. I reached the site by myself. I was just drinking some water, and when I turned around, I saw that someone was on fire. I rushed to the spot, and with one glance, I knew it was Jamphel Yeshi. When I got there, almost everything was burnt. I didn't throw any water on him. I stood there. Others were trying to douse the fire. There was a stench from the burning flesh.
Like all the other self-immolators, Yeshi left behind a letter. In the letter, Yeshi wrote as follows. What I want to convey here is the concern of the 6 million Tibetans. At a time when we are making our final move towards our goal, if you have money, it is time to spend it. If you are educated, it is the time to produce results. If you have control over your life, I think the day has come to sacrifice your life. The fact that Tibetan people are setting themselves on fire in this 21st century is to let the world know about their suffering and to tell the world about the denial of basic human rights. If you have any empathy, stand up for the Tibetan people. Copies of the letter are now on the walls of the Tibetan quarters in New Delhi. With Felix Gaitke, this is Gayatri Parmeshwaran, FSRN, Dharamshala, India.
In Wisconsin, residents and survivors are mourning the victims of Sunday's shooting massacre at a Sikh temple in Oak Creek. Six people were killed and several injured, including a police officer. The shooter, identified as 40-year-old Wade Michael Page, was killed by police. At a press conference today, a member of the Sikh community read the names of those killed.
Sita Singh, 41 years old, male. Ranjit Singh, 49 years old, male. Satwant Singh Kalika, 62 years old, male. Prakash Singh, male, 39 years old. Paramjeet Kaur, 41 years old, female. Shubhaik Singh Khatada, 84 years old, male.
Satwant Singh Kalika, one of the founders and leaders of the Gurdwara or temple, was killed trying to stop the shooter. His son, Amar Deep, described to TMJ4 what he learned about his father's last moments.
He attacked the intruder or the shooter in the lobby after gunshots were fired, got to him. There's a blood struggle. Evidence shows on the ground a blood struggle, and then my father's blood trail back to one area and the shooter's trail towards the kitchen. And at that point, what goes through my mind is, you know, my father did his best to protect the temple, but also my family and his wife and all his friends and people that were there. And he slowed the shooter down enough so other people could get to safety. And that's, I mean, it's an amazing act of heroism, but it's also exactly who he was. There'd be no way in God's green earth that he would allow somebody to come in and do that without trying his best to stop it.
Two priests were also killed, including Prakash Singh, who'd recently brought his wife and children from India to live in Oak Creek, located near Milwaukee. The shooting began Sunday morning as congregants gathered ahead of a service. Some were preparing a community meal in the kitchen. Children were downstairs studying. Although the shooter was killed, many hid for over an hour before police escorted them out. The shooting comes just over 2 weeks after another massacre in Aurora, Colorado, killed 12 and injured dozens. At a press conference this morning, Oak Creek Mayor Steve Scafidi said it's a tragic day for the community.
Oak Creek is a diverse, welcoming city. We host 23 places of worship, and the Sikh community is part of that, what makes our city strong. We will recover from this, but I want to assure everyone that we are doing everything we can, cooperating with federal agencies, local and state agencies, to get the answers we need to resolve the situation and to begin the healing process.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for Monday, August 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Martin Lemlin. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for Sore Throats, Clapping Hands with your host, Robert, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.